Yeah, there's big Trump political news today. Us, we're going to talk about that, yes, but also his economic plan from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 17th day of August. It is good, as always, to have you with us, everybody. You know, it's rare that the CEO of a niche enterprise serving a loyal but relatively small customer base goes literally overnight from that to the very big leagues. But today, in campaign 2016, that is where we find ourselves. Donald Trump has named Stephen Bannon, until this morning, the executive chairman of the conservative website Breitbart News. He's named him as the new CEO of his campaign, the hearing of which might rightly make you ask, Stephen who? Adam Allington gets us going.
Steve Bannon has a seriously colorful resume. He was a Navy officer, then an investment banker at Goldman Sachs. Then he started a boutique investment house and through a single deal ended up with a stake in this.
He's somebody!
What about me?
You're nobody.
Why him? Why not me?
You got it. Seinfeld. That deal helped bankroll his move from Wall Street to Hollywood, where he began producing hard-edged conservative documentary films. It was on the set of one of those, about Reagan, where he met Andrew Breitbart, eventually becoming the chairman of Breitbart News. That's how Bannon and Donald Trump came together, through the Breitbart News Network.
They've been really the mouthpiece of the Trump campaign in a way that Fox News was the mouthpiece of previous Republican campaigns.
Dan Cassino is an author and professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University. Under Bannon, Cassino says the network has gone all in on Trump, and that hasn't made him many friends among mainstream conservatives. Giano Caldwell is a Republican political consultant. He says the move to bring in Bannon might make some sense. Think of it as an unshakeup, while also removing any idea that Trump might temper his message for a general election.
There was a need to do something new, and I think what he's doing is something somewhat new, and it seems as though a strategy that may actually pay dividends.
So now the Trump campaign has Bannon and reportedly former Fox News CEO Roger Ailes. This has got people thinking, is this a return to the campaign's original MO, or perhaps the possible beginning of a new post-campaign media company? In Washington, D.C., I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Bannon is the sixth high-profile Steve to join the Trump campaign. You might remember the GOP nominee's economic team has five of them on it. One of the men on that team not named Steve is former Bear Stearns chief economist David Malpass. Mr. Malpass, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Kai.
You wrote in Forbes magazine on July the 26th, and this is a quote, Trump's complaints have been more detailed than his solutions, end of quote. And yet still you signed on.
That's right. Well, no, that's a big plus. He has given a clear set of why the economy isn't operating and what it would have to do in order to operate. You know, that article was probably written in late June, and so the campaign has developed pretty fast since then and is putting out a lot of the details that are needed for people to vote.
Well, let me stop you right there, sir, because he gave a speech, as you know, a big economic speech about a week, 10 days ago, which everybody had been promised, we, the voting public, had been promised would be the detail speech. And yet, by my count, there were two details in it. One, a revision to his tax plan, and the other, the child care deduction. Doesn't sound like there were a whole lot of details in that speech. And in fact, he said we're going to have more details in the weeks to come. So where are we with Mr. Trump laying out his actual economic plan as opposed to saying he's going to lay it out?
There will be more details coming forward, but there were a lot more details than two in that plan. If you look at how the parts of the economic program work together, they were clearly stated. So you have trade reform, tax reform, regulatory reform, and energy reform.
Yes, sir. All of which we've heard before, though, from Mr. Trump. That's what he wants to do. He doesn't tell us how he's going to do that.
I don't think that's a right reading of it. The speech gave lots of details in each of the areas, pretty specific on what to do about trade, what to do about energy policy, and so on. And that's really the distinction between the two candidates. Candidate Clinton wants to have tax rates be higher and doesn't have a regulatory reform plank as part of a program. These are desperately needed by the country in order to allow growth to start up. And Trump's giving plenty of detail on that, and there will be more.
Let's look at then trade, and I will ask you for the detail. How other than, and this is a really close paraphrasing, if not a direct quote of what Mr. Trump says in his speeches, how other than renegotiating bad trade deals will he change American trade policy?
Not entering into new bad trade deals is a key part of it. So what Washington wants to do is constantly have more trade deals under negotiation as a fundraising effort for the lobbyists, for the lawyers that are operating. And so stopping that motion and instead focusing on ways that trade and commerce can grow in a way that helps American workers, that's a major earth-shaking change in the direction of Washington policy.
I'm going to try that one more time, sir, because there was no detail there other than a little bit of spin on what your candidate and your views are on global trade. How specifically will Mr. Trump change American trade policy?
One is to renegotiate NAFTA. One is to have China be aware that it's not complying with the WTO rules that it signed up for, and that that is causing it to run a big trade surplus and the U.S. to run a big trade deficit. So those need to be changed. That is a lot of detail that is has already been spelled out. As we go forward, the challenge is implementing it. So you now undertake better negotiations with your trading partners.
On tax policy, virtually every analysis of Mr. Trump's tax policy notes that it will provide huge tax cuts, huge tax breaks to the wealthiest 1% of Americans. The bottom 80% get essentially nothing. Help me understand how that's going to move the American economy forward, which is what Mr. Trump repeatedly says he wants to do.
Right. I know, Kai, that economists and they're often on the other side of the political aisle are able to make those statements, but they're incorrect. So,
what's incorrect?
That there's no benefit to the people on the lower end and giant benefits to the people on the upper end. That's completely incorrect.
It's virtually every analysis of the plan, sir, that says that.
So how many analyses have been done and how many are done by liberal? So Hillary Clinton has a giant campaign fund that's spending money to get favorable analyses that attack Trump's tax plan.
So what I don't hear you saying, Mr. Malpass, is anything that says that's not true.
That's not true. The way you just described the program is absolutely not true. So the benefits from the plan come to the people because you're going to have a much faster growing economy.
Since you have mentioned Mr. Trump's desire to change Washington and change government, I'm obliged, I think, to quote you back to yourself from Forbes on July the 26th. You said, to change government will require good presidential judgment and thousands of constructive and well-vetted decisions. You believe Mr. Trump is the man to do that?
Yes, of course. And that's why I'm working on the campaign. And I think that was a key quote, I worked in both the Reagan and Bush administrations. They were effective. They tried to be effective. But what overwhelms you when you're there is the number of decisions the federal government is making. It's this giant entity that's constantly affecting people's lives. And I think they haven't been making good decisions in the current administration, and we need a better one.
David Malpass, he is a member of the Donald Trump Economic Advisory Team. Mr. Malpass, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Quick correction before we move on. Now, we said in an interview yesterday that Eva Longoria, the actress, was no longer a client at CAA, the talent agency. CAA wrote to us today to say that's not the case, so we regret the error. Wall Street, meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Those looking to build a 21st century media conglomerate could do worse than follow the example of the Spanish language broadcaster Univision. It owns Fusion, the multi-platform network aimed at younger audiences. It owns a big chunk of The Onion. It owns the African-American news and entertainment site The Root. And as of last night, and $135 million, it owns the bankrupt gossip site Gawker. Gigi Duban has more now on Univision's game plan.
Flip on Univision and you'll probably catch some of this.
When do they get?
or a little of this. Roberto F.E. Soto is a media consultant and former producer with Univision. He says if the company has a strategy in buying Gawker and other half-news, half-gossip and satire media properties, he's not sure what it is.
This was a one-time leader in Spanish language media, and they now seem to be all over the place.
Univision's core viewers used to be Latinos who came to the U.S. and wanted news and entertainment in their native language. But James Dix, media analyst at Wedbush Securities, says this is Univision's way of broadening that appeal to the bilingual set.
One of the reasons would be to attract the younger Hispanic audience that's grown up in the U.S.
Christopher Alley, who teaches media studies at the University of Virginia, says Univision is, like all old-school broadcasters, trying to stay relevant and boost revenues with younger audiences. But another goal might be to combine content.
I think the really interesting thing is, will we one day be seeing Gawker content or Gawker reporting on television?
That could be interesting. Today's top headlines on Gawker.com are all about sex, an online forum for clowns, and why there's no such thing as orange pie, as in pie made with oranges. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
We told you yesterday about Aetna pulling out of most of the Obamacare health exchanges it operates in. The company said it was losing money doing that, so out it was going. And then this morning, the Huffington Post published a letter from Aetna CEO Mark Bertolini to the antitrust division of the Department of Justice, in which Bertolini, whose company, remember, is trying to buy rival Humana, Bertolini said, and this is a quote, "It is very likely that we would need to leave the public exchange business entirely and plan for additional business efficiencies should our deal ultimately be blocked," end of quote. So, regulatory business as usual? Capitalism at its most raw and ugly? A little bit of both. From our help desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at the art of the antitrust deal.
When assessing potential mergers, regulators ask key players what kind of impact these deals would have.
They call this the but-for world.
Harvard Business School professor Limor Daphne used to work at the Federal Trade Commission.
What would happen if the merger were not going to proceed versus what would happen if the merger does go forward?
Aetna's response to that query, quote, "It's very likely that we would need to leave the public exchange business entirely," has generated a bunch of heat. In a statement today, the company said that answer should not come as a surprise, given the fact that Aetna hasn't broken even on the exchanges. Company critics interpret the letter as a veiled threat. If it was, it didn't do Aetna much good, says attorney Michael Perry at Baker Botts.
The agencies in reviewing a transaction like this, you know, really tend to be focused on the merits and aren't usually influenced by political pressure.
Perhaps what's most revealing about this particular situation is that the letter underscores Aetna's footprint has significant implications for government programs, though obviously that didn't influence DOJ. Harvard's Limor Daphne says a small number of big insurers is a concern.
The ability of a couple of large companies to potentially drastically impact a lot of consumers is a scary thing.
And raises important questions about how big and powerful any one company should be allowed to get. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
In the tech industry, at least, that's a new phenomenon that we hadn't seen before.
What do high-tech and Smucker's Jam have in common? We'll tell you, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 21 points today, a tenth percent, 18,573. The NASDAQ nudged up a single point, less than a tenth percent, 5228. The S&P 500, 4 points higher, two-tenths percent, 21.82. Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen says 50 restaurants were affected by that terrible flooding down in Louisiana. Bad news for Wall Street, though, because capitalism nationally, same-store sales came in lower than forecast. Popeye's down 5.7% today. Site One Landscape Supply, a wholesaler of landscape supplies, reported higher revenue but lower earnings than expected. Shares scraped off 5.7% today. Bond prices up. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus down to 1.55%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Even for what's turning out to be an active fire season out here, The Blue Cut fire burning east of Los Angeles is something. It went from basically nothing yesterday afternoon to 30,000 acres, almost 47 square miles today. No lives lost so far, but tens of thousands of people have been evacuated. Major highways are shut down. It is a mess. With the usual caveats that you can't credit isolated events to the macro problem of climate change, it's clear that the climate, be it fire or, as in Louisiana, water, the climate is changing. So besides everybody who's affected, you know who is also having to deal with that? Insurance companies, that's who. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim has the story.
First, there's Michael Greenstone's study. The University of Chicago econ professor looked at how some states cap the amount property insurers are allowed to charge for their premiums, even though some policyholders live in riskier areas. That, he says, is a mistake.
Insurance companies play a very valuable role in sending market signals to people.
A signal that says, maybe don't build on the coast, but if you do, shore up that house.
They are not being allowed to send that market signal. And the consequence is that we're all less prepared for climate change.
Another study shows others' misreading of the market could spell trouble for insurance companies. The Asset Owners Disclosure Project ranks the world's 500 biggest investors by how they're addressing climate risk in their holdings. Most aren't doing enough, thus putting trillions worldwide at risk. Julian Poulter is CEO of the organization. He says part of the problem is insurers tend to be over-invested in corporate bonds.
The ratings agencies who rate those bonds have really yet to come to grips with climate risk management.
In other words, whether the companies issuing the bonds, say an oil company, will have their profits affected by responses to climate change.
If those companies get into trouble because of climate regulation, because of the stigma of things like coal and fossil fuels, then it's going to be difficult to repay those bonds.
And avoiding those problems isn't the easiest task. Since they're bonds, not stocks, investors can't push for change within companies. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
From the mergers and acquisition file this week, the rental real estate market. Mid-America Apartment Communities is buying the apartment giant Post Properties for about $4 billion. That'll get the combined firm more than 100,000 rental units, mostly in the South. And with scale like that comes the ability to take advantage of rising home prices, which is to say a greater need for apartments as more Americans stay put and just rent. Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports now on the rise of a permanent renter class.
When Lindsay Brady was a teenager, she had big hopes for her 30-year-old self.
Yeah, I thought like when I turned 30, I would have a lot of my life together. And in many ways, I do. I feel like really stable and comfortable in my career. And
she loves Chicago and her job as a librarian. But Brady's still renting and has two roommates. By now, she thought she'd own a house.
The reality of having student loans and having debt wasn't really apparent to me at the time.
Brady also got a little spooked by the financial crisis.
My parents own a home, but they, you know, were kind of underwater in their mortgage.
The nation's home ownership rate, that's the percentage of homes owned by the people who live in them, is at a 50-year low, down to about 63%. On the flip side,
we've had, you know, an increase of over 8 million renters, almost 9 million renters in the past 10 years.
Daniel McHugh is with Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies, and he says a lot of renters are renting longer. Home prices are up, incomes not so much, and it's tough to qualify for a mortgage.
There's been a tightening up. It's harder. You have to, you know, more people have to save for a bigger down payment.
Meanwhile, with all those renters, costs are soaring. Rents are at an 8-year high. Lawrence Yoon, an economist with the National Association of Realtors, says declining home ownership,
it widens inequality. Homeowners, they build wealth through their houses as home prices rise.
Yoon says the vast majority of renters still plan to own a home one day. Lindsay Brady wants to, but she still has those student loans and just bought a 2012 silver Subaru. She says there won't be any more big investments until she unloads some of her debt.
Or I win the lottery.
Always an option. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
There has been in corporate America for the past couple of decades or so a rising problem of short-termism, pressures to make money right now, this quarter, if necessary, at the expense of long-term growth. Investors pretty much require it. But get this. In the 1960s, the average stock owner held a share for more than 8 years. Today, it's somewhere between 4 and 8 months. And companies don't last as long anymore either. So for the latest in our series, The Price of Profits, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports on an unusual stock structure designed to bring back some long-term corporate magic.
Here's an unusual center for corporate longevity, Oroville, Northeast Ohio. Population, 8,000. It's home to J.M. Smucker, which has been churning out apple butter and making jam since 1897. This is one of those places where the sign says, "Our churches welcome you."
This used to be one of the original Smucker farms, as I remember it.
Resident and Bob Hershey ago, has known the Smucker family and the company his Smucker's whole life. He's 90, and he has this childhood memory.
I filled my wagon with elderberries, took it down to the Smucker company, and they had a great big weighing platform, and they wrote me a check that said, "Only 35 cents, Bob." I mean, that was a small wagon. Somebody was really being very kind to me.
Down the street at Jerry's Cafe, you can hear about the company's family and corporate values. You see, for five generations, every CEO has been named Smucker. The bosses are known to walk the factory floor, and they tend to know workers by name.
You know, walk right up to people, and it was like his brother or son. And
even lowly contractors get perks, say, to the company gym.
It was the family, and they made you feel like family.
It's not your typical family company. Yes, it began with a Bible verse on the wall, "Whatsoever man soweth, that shall he also reap." But it also raised money on Wall Street as a public company from big investors like Vanguard. It's wanted it both ways, and it succeeded, says consultant Dennis Jaffe.
They've been profitable and successful for more than 100 years. That puts them in the 0.1, 0.01 percentile of family businesses.
To Jaffe, a big key is the stock structure. It gives family and friends disproportionate voting power in company decisions. Some call this tenure voting. If you hold on to a share for more than 4 years, you get 10 times more votes. This rewards long-term investors, and it weeds out the make-money-now crowd that might pressure Smuckers into, I don't know,
cutting corners to make a product more profitable, doing things that are ethically sensitive in order to get shelf representation in grocery stores. This happens more frequently than people would like to admit.
Long-term tenure voting has been a formula for steady and boring and profitable. The small number of companies with this structure has way outperformed the S&P 500. You want boring? Smucker's over the years has acquired Jif Peanut Butter, Crisco, a pet food company, and Folgers, ground coffee in a red tub. Huge money makers all. Robin Bolton is with consultancy Innosight.
They haven't chased the trends like pre-prepared coffee drinks, the frappuccinos and macchiatos and lattes. They've really kind of stayed steady and true to the core of the brand.
The Smucker's company declined to comment for this story, perhaps because there's some controversy here. See, favoring long-term investors means discriminating against short-term investors. Aisha Mastagni is portfolio manager at the California State Teacher Retirement Fund. It owns Smucker stock because it owns the whole market, but it's not happy about it.
It's very dangerous territory when you start treating investors differently. We understand it sort of came from a family-owned business. Once you tap into the capital markets, the economic interests need to match the voting interests.
That's one reason regulators in the 1980s stopped letting companies have tenure voting shares, though they did grandfather in companies like Smucker's. But now, there's interest in bringing the structure back. And it's coming from a very different sector than PB&J.
This is iPhone 6S. Not much has changed, except
Silicon Valley. Powerhouse law firm Wilson Sonsini has represented Apple and Tesla, among others. And their partner David Berger argues that patient tenure stockholders can feed innovation because breakthroughs take time. Take Tesla's electric vehicle battery plant or the Google X effort to make cancer-detecting nanoparticles.
They may fail. That's the whole notion of taking a big risk. Electric cars, whether it's through, you know, the types of moonshot projects that Google is engaged in, you want to be able to ensure that those companies have access to patient capital.
The thing is, those shoot-the-moon projects, at least measured by entrepreneurs going public, are getting harder to find. The number of public companies the last two decades has fallen from 8,000 to less than 4,000. A big fear of going public is of so-called activist investors. They're seen as not so much parking their money as doing an ATM drive-through. Venture capitalist Scott Cooper is with Andreessen Horowitz.
They're asking the companies to take cash and either give a dividend back to shareholders or to do buybacks on stocks.
That is, spending company money to boost the stock price instead of, say, making the next product.
In the tech industry, at least, that's a new phenomenon that we hadn't seen before.
So tech companies have a couple options to fend this off. They can go public and give new investors hardly any voting rights, which is what Facebook and Google do, or they can let them earn voting rights over time. This is tenure voting, the way they do it back at Smuckers. And the whole point of tenure voting is to grow and still stay true to the vision of the founder, whether it's Apple Butter or Apple Computers. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We've got that whole series, Price of Profits, articles, videos, the whole deal. It's online at priceofprofits.org. This final note on the way out today, which I will preface by saying that I know sometimes I come off as cynical, too cynical perhaps, and your comments on same have been noted. That said, it's hard not to raise an eyebrow when there is stuff like this in the news. McDonald's is going to make fitness trackers the gifts in the Happy Meals the kids get. The things will either blink faster or slower depending on how quickly the kid wearing it moves around. It'll count steps as well. So, you know, that's good. Oh, it's tight. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday are the engineers. I'm Kyle Rizdahl. We'll see you. Oh, and this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.